Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of The Chief Psychology Officer with Dr. Amanda Potter, Chartered Psychologist and CEO of Zircon, and I'm Christian Lees-Bell, Senior Consultant at Zircon.
Hello.
Hello.
And hello.
Today, we're invited guests for a second time, and after meeting Dulcie and Ian last year to discuss finding inner confidence on the 25th of September and receiving so much positive feedback, we wanted to get you both back in to talk again with us, as it became clear that you've got all sorts of hacks and tips to make science simple that really resonate with our listeners.
I completely agree, Christian. How fantastic that we've got Dulcie and Ian back. I love the way Dulcie's mind works. I love her thinking. I love some of the little statements that she makes, and I steal them and I've been borrowing them along the way, which is just so fab. And Ian is such a deep-rooted expert around neuroscience. And I think we all fundamentally agree that we are a bundle of biases, that our brains lie to us, that we're inherently lazy, that we're all prone to these quite crippling things like imposter syndrome. So the hacks and the tips that you've mentioned to help us be much more action focused and be much more positive in life is just brilliant, which is why we've asked them back today.
We enjoyed doing the last podcast so much. I learned a lot as well. And much as we have so many biases, there are definitely some lights at the end of the tunnel with some of the tricks and hacks and strategies that Dulcie and Ian, you're going to share today. So the plan today is to pack in as many of those tips as we can, but focus primarily on personal effectiveness and some practical things that you can do to work smarter and not harder. And using a little bit of science to enhance your relationships at work and at home would be fantastic to talk about as well.
It's an absolute pleasure to be back with you talking about top tips for personal effectiveness. And Dulcie and I, this is something that has been an ongoing conversation for the last 3 years, I think, Dulcie, hasn't it?
More than that.
The thing here, I think, for us is it's an ever-evolving thing, because our brains, as far as we know, the most complicated thing we know in the universe, and it's very plastic to the day we die. So as a result, light at the end of the tunnel here, Christian, as you're saying, is that we can do something about it. And the research suggests that as well.
I love the fact that our brains are constantly evolving and learning so that we can overcome those biases and those shortcuts and our lazy brain syndrome and our lying brain syndrome. Actually, I don't like the word syndrome. I dropped syndrome because of you, Dulcie, and my imposter syndrome. I renamed
it
Imposter Moments. I did, because I really liked that from our last podcast.
What does that say, Amanda, about how our brains work to you?
Well, I'm learning. I'm picking up the pieces I enjoy and recognize and attend to and realize, and I'm trying to embed them in my everyday language. But the point is that I've got some bad habits. So I use that word syndrome, and I'm trying not to use it. Every time I do it, I catch myself and I move on.
Brilliant.
But isn't it funny though, in you calling that out, Amanda, and saying, as you did in your very generous introduction about me, that straight away that gives me a little flash of imposter thinking, as I call it, that you've said you've stolen my stuff. And then I have to do the thing where I go, hang on, no. You're supposed to accept that as a compliment, Dulcie. You're supposed to take a step back and be able to respond to that as what it was intended to be, which was an opportunity to be sociable and to accept the compliment. What a massive irony that you just kicked off my imposter thinking by saying you steal my stuff when you're the CPO.
Yeah. Oh, that's so funny. But I really do genuinely like your thinking. And
thank you.
In one way, it's great because Christian, Ian and I are all very similar in that we've got psychology and neuroscience behind us. But Dulcie, you came into this from the HR world.
Yeah.
From the application of a lot of the thinking that we do, which is why I like your thinking and your approach, because you're much more practical. You're much more pragmatic and you say it as it is. But that's a nice intro to you, Dulcie. So why have we invited you back here today, Dulcie?
Do you know what? It's really interesting, isn't it? Because when I wrote my book, people kept saying to me, oh, are you a neuroscientist or a psychologist? And I find myself apologising for what you've just described as my superpower, if you like, that actually I'm not a psychologist or a neuroscientist. I'm somebody who, actually, I didn't move into HR until my mid-30s. Prior to that, I worked in operations, I worked in finance, property, brand development and commercial for a big FTSE 100 initially, and then FTSE 250 organisation. I just became fascinated by the science, but only to the extent of, oh, where can I use that and how can I use that? So when I came to specialise, which is how I describe my HR life now, I was in my mid-30s at that point. And it was then that I sort of thought, whoa, hang on, all this stuff I've been collecting like a magpie all these years, suddenly it's got a place. Actually, when I'm talking to people about how they can increase their capacity for work, how they can get more done in less time, how they can stay motivated in difficult circumstances, that's the kind of what you deal with in HR, right? How to get on with people better, how to motivate yourself when life's really tough. For me, that's when I started going lean on this stuff I'd been collecting for years. But yeah, that's me. I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a neuroscientist. I like to call out truths, I suppose. And I suppose a bit of the psychology and neuroscience helps me to think that the truths I call out have got evidence. I'm not just giving something as an opinion. I'm giving something as an informed opinion based on the fact that the science says it's so, added to an observation. How does that help us? So it's always collaborative, but with the science as a sort of partner in the room, I suppose. Does that help? That felt as though that was a bit of a rambling introduction, but
no, yeah, it's great.
Did lots of stuff before that and still get that sense of an imposter, even when people say, you know, you're a HR professional. I think, well, yeah, only recently. And then I think, actually, it's 20 years now, Dulcie, because doesn't time fly?
Doesn't it? But I think we've missed the most important point, which is the book. The book that we're here to talk about, and also the science and the neuroscience behind the book, which is, it's not bloody rocket science. I mean, the title says it all. You're all about bringing practicality, pragmatism, and kind of cutting through the complexity and making it really simple for the reader so that they can lead and manage in a really effective way.
Well, no, thank you. And I got the name from the fact that from Yorkshire as well. And it was just a phrase we had growing up, which is, it's not bloody rocket science. So the intention is, you sort of, you know, you use that sort of accent when you're saying it, because I suppose when I was growing up, I was in a family where nobody'd really been to university. Nobody had ever had an academic life particularly around me. But I just had this idea that, well, how hard can some of this stuff be? And just because nobody else has done it around me, well, why can't I do it? And actually, it's a phrase you hear a lot in Yorkshire. It's not bloody rocket science. And I just used it to keep reminding myself that I didn't need to feel like an imposter in a world where nobody looked or sounded quite like me. So when I came to write a book, it felt like it kind of summed me up, really. Keep it simple. Don't make it more complicated than it needs to be. Tell the truth and be kind. And for me, that it kind of encompassed all those things.
And you said earlier about truths, calling out the truths. What would you say is the most important truth that you have from this book or from your research?
Gosh, that's a really big question. Probably two, if I can be greedy. So the first one, and it's chapter one, actually, of the book called Lies, is that you think you can trust your own brain, right? You think you can trust, like, that what you've seen and what you've heard, and you then trust your ability to process that in a fairly balanced way. And I think we become more prone to that problem as we get older, when actually what the truth is that you can't trust your own brain. Your brain lies to you all the time. It distorts the truth and it deletes bits of it, mostly to save fuel, because actually hearing something different and doing something different is quite difficult for us. So I think that's the first truth, that you cannot trust your own brain. It's not telling you the truth, because for me, once you stand back from that, is a huge win. The second one is related, I guess, in the sense that you're never finished. And I have a phrase that is, if you're finished, you're finished. Because actually, even if you think you know all there is to know about something and you're a real technical expert, that point where you stop looking for why you might be wrong, why the truth has changed, why the circumstances around the truth has changed, that for me is the kind of second big truth. And when I'm talking to clients, whether I'm training or coaching, fundamentally, they're the two things that you come back to, is keep growing. And appreciate you don't always tell yourself the truth, because then, you know, whether it's a friend or a coach or a mentor or whatever role you use other people for, you are willing to listen to them speaking truth to you about their observations.
It's so interesting. Sarah will say to me that I'm much better if I've got something unfinished, if I've got a target or a goal to work towards. I can get quite low once it's achieved. I don't like finishing things. I complete a finisher, if we think of the old Belbin definition. I'm a massive complete finisher, but I can feel quite despondent once I've actually finished something. So that's so interesting. It's all about the dopamine system, isn't it? And needing reward.
Do you know what? I'm not a completer finisher, but you've just made me think, because I'm the ultimate non-completer finisher. Like, people who know me well laugh at me that nothing's ever finished. But I wonder if that's what I'm trying to put off, is that actually if something's finished, I know that I'm going to have this like, oh, it's done,
drop,
it's over.
The deep, yeah.
Well, actually, you've just made me feel loads better about being kind of a non-completer finisher. And I've always felt as though I should do better, Amanda. So I feel better about that with you just having made that comment, because it's given me a different way to think about it.
I'm so glad. And Ian, as our neuroscientist in the room, having read the book, having worked with Dulcie for the last few years, what's the thing that you took from the book and from Dulcie's thinking that resonated the most for you?
I think you're hearing it as Dulcie speaks about it, and it's the application. I worked with the BBC for a couple of years with a Human Mind Outreach program, and it's a real knack to be able to communicate science with a fidelity, and even more so to reach people at just the right amount at just the right time. I think Dulcie's got a real knack for doing that, and I've learned a tremendous amount of how to communicate with people, certainly in business. And I think, Dulcie, when you say I'm not a neuroscientist or I'm not a psychologist, I see you as an applied psychologist, as an applied neuroscientist, for what it's worth.
That's, I'm going to put that on my CV.
Ian said.
Yeah.
Dr. Ian says. And what brought me to the book was, and this is going back a little bit to the imposter thinking. When I read the book, it was just through one of the lockdowns. I can't remember which one, but I remember being sat outside and it was a sunny time. So I'm assuming it was in the summer. And I was reading through it. And again, with my previous experience and thinking, you know, this makes so much sense. I love the way that Dulcie's packaged it. And there's a fun part. And I think we've spoken already in the past, at least on a previous podcast, about Find Your Flock. I thought this is somebody that I would like to get to know. And we happened to be working with a similar provider at the time. So I reached out and said, hey, you know, you've written this book. Can we have a chat? little did I know that I'd just thrown Dulcie into a complete imposter moment. And it's still, we quote it now. And I just didn't think about that, because in my mind, it was brilliant. And it's so good. I've written a foreword for the book.
Well, I was going to say, it's a really good story. I mean, I'm, you know, hugely grateful for a neuroscientist having written a foreword for the second edition, right? Because that's like, well, it's proper now. But the story that Ian's talking about is such a salient lesson into how you don't know what's going on in somebody else's brain and how you have to take a really good look at what's happening in yours. Because Ian did reach out to me and he said, oh, I'm Dr. Ian Price, I'm a neuroscientist, and I'd like to talk to you about your book. Well, at that moment, that is what I thought, this is the real moment where your past catches up with you. You know, we talk about the imposter thinking being like an old-fashioned policeman in our house. So we envisage that at some stage in mine and my husband's life, this old-fashioned policeman's going to like give us a whistle and go, knock, come on, the pair of you. We've been after you for years. You've had a good innings, and fair play to you, good game. But your time is now officially up. So come on, hand back the car, the house, and, you know, the happy life. And honestly, I thought that was my moment. I was like, a neuroscientist wants to, like, point out the flaws. So I was thinking, well, it'd be a good thing if you face up to it, Dulce, because then you'll know what's wrong. And actually, you are brave enough to face this. And if it's nothing illegal, if it's just wrong, that's easy enough. You can edit it and it'll be all the better for it. But I really had to sort of build myself up to getting back in touch with Ian to go, yeah, sure, that'd be really good. I'd be really grateful for that. Anyway, it turned out he just really enjoyed the book and he just reached out.
That's so crazy.
I feel awful that I put it's you through, like, all of that. And because it,
there's some messages there, Ian, for your email writing. Dulcie, we need a word.
Yes.
There was nothing at all wrong with his writing. It was all my lies in my head about something that wasn't even a thing. So we joke about it now, because the thing is that when people see you, like, people see me on telly or hear me on the radio or on a podcast like this, people will go, well, she can't possibly still be experiencing imposter thinking. She must now be at a stage where she's got enough evidence. But all that happens is you've got more evidence of all the things that have nearly gone wrong. So in my experience, literally just build up that evidence. And certainly when I studied to become a coach at Henley, one of our tutors said most coach topic at executive level is imposter syndrome, as they called it. But as I say, I don't call it that now. And actually everything in my own experience has borne that out, is this doesn't go away. So mine just comes along for the ride now, Amanda. Literally,
yeah,
I've just got mine like coming along for the journey. And I just sort of have it as a reminder that I'm humble enough to still experience it, a reminder about what the science says, that having that imposter thinking does indicate that you've got a brain that is capable of that kind of reflection. So that's a good sign. And also I read something that said it also means you're not a psychopath. So I just kind of go, still not a psychopath. So
bingo.
Every time still I have a burst of it now, I just remind myself of the positive stuff and go, yep, I'm just still not a psycho. So that's really good.
Yeah, not a narcissist, not a psychopath. Love that. But we know also that when we're the most depleted, most tired, most drained, then we are more likely to have those imposter thinking, imposter moments. And so we need to look after ourselves. So Christian, what did you love about the book? What did you take away or was the most poignant or significant for you?
I really loved the imposter chapter. I think that you're the way that you frame. I was the same as you, Amanda. I used to say imposter syndrome. I never felt completely comfortable with it, but those, that idea of imposter moments. I also loved the reminder of the importance of social connections, and actually kind of jog my memory around the quote that I absolutely love by a guy called Ed Halliwell, who's a psychiatrist and expert on ADHD. And his quote was, never worry alone. Probably an extremely simple quote, but so powerful. Just that process of not worrying alone, I think, does two things. It makes us feel less vulnerable. And number two, it means that it gives us a sense of control as well by talking and by sharing. And I think your book also reminded me of actually, yeah, going back to that quote and developing connections with people when times are tough, I think, because it helps us to problem solve once we share the problem. And then also we can laugh about it as well sometimes.
So I always get my quotes wrong, but it's like a problem shared is a problem halved. Is that right? Is that a quote?
Yeah, yeah. Never worry alone.
Never just worry bit, alone.
Yeah.
I've written that one down, Christian. Stealing that. Look, literally written it down like a magpie. Stolen.
Typical Dulcie.
Totally.
Typical
three words. Dulcie. Even I can remember it. Yeah.
And so what, in your mind, Dulcie, are the real practical applications? Because a lot of clients will say to us, and so what? You've given us this incredible insight. For us within Be Talent, we have all these incredible tools that help us to raise self-awareness, to help people to acknowledge where they are on a journey of some kind, what their strengths are, the resilience, psych safety, and so on. But very often at the end of the workshop, they'll say, okay, so what do we do? What's the so what that I need to take away? What's the so what of this book for you, Dulcie?
Well, I'm obsessed by the so what, because my last corporate job was buying training. And I used to ask that same thing, which is like, well, we've had somebody in the room and they've given us some really good training, but so what? What's changed? And it used to really frustrate me when nothing had changed as a result. So what I did in the book was actually put the so what's in it. I think the chapters are actually called Got It. So now so what? Because it's like, yeah, you can get the signs, but what are you going to do with it? So in the book, there's things like top right questions to ask yourself, or top right questions that you can ask other people. And by top right, I mean questions that are really high in trust. They're there to build the relationship with somebody, but they're really challenging at the same time. They're strong questions that should get you somewhere. I suppose the top tip that kind of sits across the whole thing is to get into the habit of thinking about your thinking. And this takes us back to the first point I made about you can't trust yourself in some ways. It links into your quote about not worrying alone, Christian, that actually if you're talking to yourself and that's the only way that you're processing the challenges that you're facing, how can you see them for what they are when you're likely to get in your own way? So I've got a number of ways that I personally use to think about my thinking, and I sort of pass those on and share them. Journaling's really well known about, and that is a great way to think about your thinking. And all you need is like, you know, literally a pen and a piece of paper, right? You can buy a journal, but literally mm-hmm. you just get a pen and some post-its and think about your thinking. But one I really like to do to help people to have a framework for it is I call it the sphere of influence. And I get people to literally draw three rings. So trying to describe it on here, I'm going to make it sound much more complicated than it actually is. But if you imagine a fried egg, that's sort of two rings. If you were going to draw a children's version of a fried egg, that's two rings. Now put another one round the edge of it and that's your three rings. And the idea is to write down all the things that are bothering you. And sometimes with clients, we might do this on a flip chart. We might draw it on the wall and we might use post-its because then you can move them around. But the idea is dump or download everything that's on your mind and then put it into one of those three rings. So the inner ring is things that you can control. Things that if you've got that post-it and it says, oh, I'm really frustrated about this, and it's something you can control, like, I don't know, I've had a dripping tap in my bathroom for ages and I keep forgetting and it's keeping me up at night. You could do something about that right now. So you would just do it now and get it off the list. And that would be something that's kind of in the control box. The next box around is the you can influence it circle. I get people to think about this one carefully because quite often we've got something that's bothering us that we could influence it, but we can't control it. So this could be something that's happening at work. It could be a process that's frustrating you, or it could be a relationship with a member of your family where you can influence it to some extent, but you can't change somebody else's behaviour. You can hope to influence it by being truthful with them, but you can't control the outcome. And what I say to people with stuff in this middle circle is have a really good think about how much influence you've got over it. Have a think about how much time and effort it's going to take you to influence it. And try and match the amount of time and effort it's going to take with the amount of influence you have over it. And also how important it is to you. Because I've spent hours trying to influence things that fundamentally, when I step back from it, I don't care that much about it. It's just I've got my soapbox about it. And now I feel like I'm almost going to waste even more time if I don't fix it. And it's a real fool's errand, right? So try and balance the amount of time. Try and do some maths with the ratios, if you like, because I'm quite a logical person. Match whether it's important to you with how much time you're going to spend on it, and only spend time on something that's genuinely important to you and you've got high influence over. Now, it's not beyond the wit of us all to realise there's an outer circle. And the outer circle is things you can't control or influence. Now, seriously, if I had a pound for every hour I've spent thinking and pondering and trying to problem solve around things I've got no control or influence over, I'd be a really, really wealthy woman. The amount of airtime this stuff gets in our heads is awful when you think about it. But you only really start to see it when you've kind of mapped it out. And I love doing that with clients because we'll map it out. As I say, quite often we'll do it in big with post-its because then we can move them around. Because do you know what? All you can do with the stuff in that outer circle, which you can't control and you can't influence, is learn to live with it as soon as you can. And for me, when I get clients to physically take the post-it off and go, how are you just going to learn to live with that? Even just taking the post-it off the piece of paper or crossing it out if you're journaling. Or sending it to somebody and say, if you ever hear me talking about this again, to Christian's point of, you know, never worry alone. It's like, maybe don't rant alone. Literally go, can I have permission to rant? And then your friend says, remember, every minute you're spending on this, Dulcie, is actually a waste of your time and effort. Do you really want to put your time there? For me, that's one of the simplest things that I do with people. I use it myself all the time on me. And I think that's one of the most simple tools that comes out of the book. And people tell me all the time, go, I love that one because I go back to it. And that's always the biggest compliment, isn't it? When people don't use a tip once, they go, oh, I use that all the time now. It's really helpful. And I've shared it with loads of other people. That's the moment where my heart sings because I'm not trying to build a training empire. I'm trying to change the world one cup of tea at a time. And when people use your stuff over a cup of tea with somebody else, that's the bit that makes me, I'm reluctant to say proud of myself because I find it really hard.
You should be proud.
Definitely I know, and proud. I'm practicing at being proud of myself.
Yeah, come on, Dulcie.
But it's quite hard to
absolutely.
Yes, yeah? But it's those moments where I do try and allow myself to be proud of myself in that moment.
So let's just summarise that. Then we've got three circles. Centre circle, what you can control.
Yeah.
Second circle, what you can influence, but it's not completely within your control.
Yeah.
And you need to balance your time and effort for that one. And then the outer circle, what you can't control and you can't influence. And let's not spend too much energy focusing on that.
We said about an applied neuroscientist. I was hearing there transformational neuroscientist because that transformation in, as you said, over a cup of tea. One of my many interests is around that metacognition. We're sharing with other people, but externalizing what we're thinking, because absolutely that's the thing that makes us spiral. And when we start to spiral, we tend to get into our threat response. And suddenly, a little bit, if I may, Amanda, like, you know, you were saying breaking bad habits. Well, the thing is, we go back, our brain will still go back to those habits. We know that. And it just reemphasizes, I think, when I work with clients as well, and for myself, is that recognize that actually the proof ultimately is in the pudding when we, under pressure, go back to the new healthier habit. And that's genuinely the thing we go to. At the same time, being kind to ourselves, Amanda, I'm totally hearing that,
yeah.
You know, when you're not hitting, you know, if you're going back to the older habit, because ultimately this is about creating habits that are healthy, and the healthy ones are creating newer habits, essentially creating stronger pathways. And it's those stronger pathways that we wanted to come back. The old pathways don't just disappear.
So they're there.
They stay there and they become smaller. They're essentially like an old road that starts to get a bit grassy and overgrown. And we know that things are working well in our healthier habits, and that transformational space that Dulcie is talking to us about. In fact, we're all talking about, that's that space where we know under pressure we've gone to the new healthier habit. And what I love about that lovely diagram is, again, it's just helping us to focus where our attention goes. Where the attention goes, the energy flows, and that is biophysically absolutely
love that
true.
Quote. Still my favorite quote from the last podcast, and still going to be one of my favorite from this podcast too. Can I just check then, Ian, are you saying if I had two habits, I'm a bit unclear about this, and one habit would be healthy, so it's the go out, take in the panorama, go for the walk in the morning and get the exercise, and then I had another habit which may be less healthy, I don't know, I don't drink coffee, but imagine a cup of coffee and a piece of toast each morning, are the healthy habits more enduring than the unhealthy habits? Is that what you said? I was just a bit confused.
What it is, it's that, again, where the attention goes, the energy flows. So this is about reusing the pathways that you want, and particularly when under pressure. So what Dulcie's just talked to us about there is things that are in our control. Sphere of influence is the next part of that diagram. Beyond that is the things that are beyond our control. And the reality is that we all know this and feel this, that when we feel threatened, and that generally is things that are out of our control, because one of the things, and again, Dulcie talks about this brilliantly in the book when she talks about the model scarf, the A for scarf is autonomy.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things here is, have we got autonomy, and can we allow our brain to have autonomy to reinforce the behavior that we most want? Unfortunately, Amanda, as much as we would like to have the healthy habit, and as much as we practice it, and there's many a book calling it, Gladwell talks about 10,000 hours, it doesn't work quite like that. Because ultimately, and listeners will get this, it's under pressure. That's when we know ourselves. It's why, you know, Winston Churchill, I think, says bravery is not just a virtue, it's by which all other virtues are tested. There's something a bit like that with the brain, because ultimately that's when you know something has become a genuine habit.
When we're under pressure.
So it's that practicing for, and I think, again, this is the other thing that we do as coaches, right, is that we help clients to consider, and I think Dulcie's, again, mentioned that really in the diagram, is we help people to think, how could it feel, and what could you do, and what would you do if something got in the way? Because ultimately, one of the best things you can do is you can train your brain in preparation for, but then there's that going through a difficult time. And this is why, you know, if you think about any emergency services or armed forces and the like, particularly under stressful situations, they practice and train hard. And the idea is that you fight easy, but it's not just about that. It's about actually the debrief afterwards. What are we going to learn? What to take away? One of the things I think brilliantly that Dulcie captures in It's Not Bloody Rocket Science is chunking, you know, review and chunk down. And then that's what your focus becomes. And that's, again, what we're ultimately saying with that diagram, Dulcie, right, is that you chunk it down to things that are tangible and doable. If you incrementally do that in a pathway that's healthy for you, then you're going to get more of that. We are what we do.
Yeah.
We are what we think, actually, more importantly.
Do you know what? I suppose what I've just done there is exactly that. You call me like a transformational neuroscientist, so I'm going to have that, or an applied neuroscientist. But the only reason that that has potentially become true is because I've repeated that science and shared it with people so many times. So I didn't know that stuff until I was past my 30s. I then knew it and read about it. I then knew it and practiced it in my own life. But it's only when I've shared it with other people, and then I've kept sharing it with other people and kept sharing it with other people and kept sharing it with other people, that now, even under pressure, those habits stick for me as an individual who's always learning and growing, is never finished, and whose own brain lies to them. So actually, it's only in retelling those stories time and time again in front of audiences, in front of clients, that actually embeds it for itself, for me personally. And you just talking about that then, about the neuroscience of that, helps me to understand now why I'm better at doing it for me.
Can I add to that as well? This is about, you know, same circles in a sense. You know, there's the comfort zone, stretch zone, and then panic zone. And what we're talking about here is, I don't like it when something ends. I like the idea of that stretch, right? So we're into that sort of stretch space. So comfort beyond that, okay, stretching is to try and accept or want to challenge myself in a certain area, in a certain direction. The diagram that Dulcie's just described helps us to be intentional about that whole process. Again, far more efficient, more effective. It's easier to review. Mm-hmm. And then what happens is that sort of middle circle, that sort of, you know, comfort zone starts to expand. It goes into that stretch zone. And one of the things we know, if you want the brain to be particularly receptive, is getting that lovely balance. And it is unique for every person, and it changes throughout life, of course. That balance between something that is new and is sparkly, and there's that element of, yeah, dopamine and serotonin and all of those sort of things. But it's also counter to that is that, you know, being careful of the cortisol and the stress response. So, you know, pressure's good, stress is not so good. And it's getting that right balance. And, you know, both Dulcie and I, we've worked with elite athletes in particular. That's something athletes really, really understand. Mm-hmm. Stretching in a defined space of what it is, the behavior that they're after, in a way in which they can easily sort of feed back and get into that, again, habit. And this is all the stuff that ultimately, which are what we think, our habits ultimately reflect a lot about who we are. It's about going from conscious incompetence all the way through down to unconscious competence. But it ultimately comes through repetitiveness and practicing what we need. And again, I love the idea, this shouldn't be done by yourself. Maybe even never train alone in that sense.
What's lovely about this is that quietening the busy mind. So when I'm anxious, when I'm stressed, not in a good way, I have a really busy mind, and it's where I find it hard to sort my thoughts out. And I really like that model for actually just quietening and helping myself to recognize what's within my control, and therefore, how can I take action? What can I influence? I'm already thinking about family and home situations, things that are outside my control, but hopefully I can have some influence. And then some things that, like you say, Dulcie, they're completely outside of your control. So drop it, leave it, walk away from it. I think that's great. Christian, over to you. I'm thinking about the psychology now, and also from your therapeutic side. What can people do to help quieten a busy mind from your side?
Oh, great question. I think when I reflect back on some of my current work and coaching, particularly around helping people to manage be difficult, challenging, sort of high pressure situations, and then also experiences as a therapist as well, particularly as a hypnotherapist many years ago, a few things I think really made the difference. So I think, you know, we've talked about this before, think something as simple as breathing techniques, relaxation. I know that when I'm feeling more relaxed and I feel more grounded through doing either the, you know, physiological sigh, box breathing, or a breathing technique, it calms the mind. Your racing thoughts can slow down, I think, just purely through that physical relaxation. I think the way that we talk to ourselves, and we all talk to ourselves, even if it's not out loud, so our internal dialogue, when we've got that sort of racing, chattering mind, if we think about how we talk to ourselves in that way, it's often frustrated, high-pitched, aggravated, the opposite of calm. So I think being self-aware of how we're talking to ourselves and practicing self-compassion, which I know we've mentioned on a previous podcast, and actually just taking stock, slowing down and saying, okay, would I be talking to myself like this if I was talking to a six-year-old? So I call it the six-year-old rule. So would I say this to a six-year-old, what I'm saying to myself now? There are lots of other really, you know, powerful self-compassion techniques just to bring down that cortisol level. And I think lastly, visualization. Most of us can visualize. I think there's a disorder called aphantasia where people do struggle to come up with visual stimuli, but the large majority of us can actually physically create images. We can close our eyes and we can imagine a beach scene. We can imagine being stressed and we can imagine being relaxed. I think not enough of us leverage that visual imagery to actually, as you said, Ian, where your focus goes, energy flows. Visualization, I think, is one really powerful way to be able to direct that focus. So if I think about how I'd like to be talking to myself, how I'd like to feel during that day, one of the things I do in the morning is I imagine my best self, and I close my eyes for just a couple of seconds and I visualize how that best future self, Christian, will be overcoming challenges, how he'll be talking to himself when he's going through something difficult. And I find that, and that's helped a lot of my clients too, to be able to face the challenges and direct people's attention. Lots of different techniques, but those are some that I think I've found really useful for myself and for others.
Stolen again. I've written down 6-year-old rule. It's like I'm conscious about how we speak to ourselves, but having a 6-year-old in your mind is really helpful, isn't it?
Yeah, would you say that?
Yeah, 100%. I was going to add, Amanda, to that about Ian mentioned scarf. In my life, I find that sharing that bit of neuroscience sometimes helps people to just understand what they physically feel, because SCARF's not my model. It's David Rock came up with a model, and it's an acronym. And it's the things that trigger our Paleolithic fight or flight response. Ian's helped me to describe this accurately enough in science, but we've got some really old wiring, basically, that used to be dead useful when we lived in caves, but is not terrifically useful now in modern life. And David Rock's SCARF acronym helps us to understand the modern threats that trigger that Paleolithic threat response, which is either fight, argue back, not always the best strategy in modern life, flight, so running away from a bear used to be a really good idea, but running away from your problem or your workplace and just leaving the room, often not a great one. Freeze is another one, less well known, but you know, there's moments where you literally can't think of anything to say, not great, but actually when you were standing stock still so that the bear didn't spot you moving in the trees, really, really good move. Or appease. So appease is one where you are saying yes when you mean no, or you're going with the crowd. You're going with everybody else to keep you safe. So they are 4 fundamentally really good ways to survive, but they're not ever so useful if we don't understand the triggers. And the SCARF acronym helps us to understand that threats to our sense of certainty. We thought this was going to happen and now it's not. And status, I thought I was the expert on this and somebody's just pulled the rug from under me. So that's why I kind of got into that zone when Ian phoned me up as a neuroscientist and wanted to chat about my book. You've then got autonomy, which Ian's already mentioned. So I thought I was in control of this and somebody's removed that control from me. Relatedness, which is, I thought we got each other. And you've just said something that means, I don't think we do get each other. And actually, that's made me really react. Or fairness, and they think this is one of the primary triggers, that when we don't think something is fair, that threat response is triggered. Now, so far, so good, but it's when I understood the physiology of this, it helped me hugely with applying the tips that Christian's talked about, like breathing. It's kind of why it matters. Because what the science helps us to understand is that when we are in the grip of fight and we feel our muscles tense up, what's actually happening in our bodies is that the blood and oxygen that normally powers the prefrontal cortex, so the bit of our brain that deals with all our decision making, our critical thinking, it's depleted of blood and oxygen to go and get you ready for a scrap. So physically, the tensing in your muscles, we don't walk around with an oxygen tank and a blood transfusion monitor. The blood and oxygen's got to come from somewhere. And turns out we didn't need that prefrontal cortex all that much when we lived in caves. So our body got used to draining it from here to go and power our threat response. So just knowing that science means that if somebody at work feels really cross and loses their temper or freezes and thinks, oh, I don't know what to say, when they know that actually it's just physiologically really normal and that Christian's tip about a deep breath actually works because it gives you a minute and it restores the blood and oxygen to the prefrontal cortex that was in your muscles and making you tense. It means that you understand why those things are real, practical, actionable tips that actually work for your physiology. And you can't like argue with where blood and oxygen's going in your body. It's like irrefutable fact. So when somebody used to say to me, oh, you just need to take a deep breath and calm down, it was like, how do you know what I need? Yeah, you just get even more
don't tell me.
Whereas if you know that actually taking a deep breath and just having a pause sends the blood and oxygen to your prefrontal cortex that was in your muscles, it's like, ah, I'm not being patronised by somebody taking a deep breath. It's actually real, hard, irrefutable science. And just sharing that science, some people have told me that learning about SCARF has changed their lives because they no longer get their imposter trigger by the fact that they couldn't think of what to say when this really important person asked them something, or that they didn't speak up when something was really unfair and they should have done, and therefore they don't deserve the job they've got or the positional power they've got. you just go, no, it's really normal. It's just the blood and oxygen leaving your prefrontal cortex. When people get that, they go, oh, okay, so I don't need to feel like an imposter. I'm perfectly capable of doing this. It was just in the moment I physically couldn't. I found helps people so much.
So Ian, what's actually happening then in the brain when we take a deep breath?
It's bringing on what we call the vagal tone. So one of our many cranial nerves, and it's an interesting nerve in itself, actually, because it's afferent and efferent. So it basically means it can send information and then receives information. So when we're taking a breath, it really brings on what we call the vagal or parasympathetic tone. Sympathetic is that actionable stuff. And I can see Christian nodding. So I'm sure you've seen this all the time with your therapy. So when you come, somebody's very sympathetically activated, they're saying, you know, ready, G'd up physically, you know, can't sit still, all those kind of things. And as Dulcie's saying, you know, ready for a fight or running away. So the breathing is a really good way, and that square box breathing you're talking about. And I'm always amazed that square box breathing is essentially breathe in through your nose, hold for four, breathe out through your mouth for four, and then repeat. And it's that ultimately it's that kind of square box breathing that is really one of the best ways of very quickly, in fact, you're just taking a deep breath, as Dulcie said, you're activating that parasympathetic. The really powerful thing here, and I'm relating it actually in this conversation in the way that I haven't done before, which is that six-year-old, because there's two parts to that, I think. The first part is we are not just more logical when we allow our brains, our prefrontal cortex, to be more perfused, that's more blood and oxygen coming to it, but we're actually becoming more creative. And what I mean by creative is that we see opportunity. So one of the hard parts is that when we're in that sort of fight, flight, freeze or appease mode that Dulcie's talking about, we all know this, we get sort of blinkered. But that sort of breathing, and again, David Rock talks about this, in terms of opening up your bandwidth, you see more things, you're more creative. Navy SEALs have a mantra, slow is smooth, smooth is fast. I think we spoke about that in the previous podcast about how powerful that is. And the other thing that the Navy SEALs are told to do at any time, no matter where they are in the world, is to do that square box breathing, because it's training. We've talked about habits, training them in the moment when it is really under fire, literally, you can go into that creative and you start to open up the possibilities. You can slow down. And the six-year-old part is coming to this as well, is that I think we've mentioned this in off-air talks, but the saddest thing for me is that NASA did some research looking at where would they find the next rocket scientists. And this is back in the sort of 60s and 70s. And the tests that they were doing, and we could argue about that, but the tests that they were doing ultimately said that pretty much 98%+ of the population in America at the time of being about three could be a rocket scientist. They were genius levels. As we go through primary, secondary or equivalent tertiary education, that unfortunately diminishes, and you can sort of see these different steps in the research that said ultimately that only 2% of the population by the time we're adults or young adults could be that genius rocket scientist. Again, this is coming back to how Dulcie talks about this in her book. She talks about literally breathing allows us to become more clever. I'd also add from this conversation, it allows us to become more childlike in the possibilities that we now see and the choices that we can choose in that moment to go with whatever the training or the best habit that we actually wanted to have, rather than that sort of knee jerk. It works on so many different levels. And here's the real, real best bit of it, I think, for me, is the more you practice it, the more you just take in that moment, the more confident and competent you become with that uncertainty or that moment. And rather than people looking at you going, oh my goodness, you're hesitating, you're not very confident, it's completely the opposite. People go, oh my goodness, you took a moment and you were thinking about it and then you were more intentional about your actions. And from a therapy point of view, I mean, it'd be interesting to hear from you, Christian, but certainly therapy that I've had for myself, that has been one of the most powerful things. Takeaway for me from this little conversation today is, can we be more childlike if we do some good breathing, if we're aware of the neuroscience that's going on? And I mean that in the sense of, could I allow my genius six-year-old out? Funnily enough, I did a What's Your Mental Age? And my family came out with all sorts of, my children of like 20s. My wife was way beyond 50s. My physical mental age, apparently, in theory, was 7.
Love that.
So maybe I'm closer than I thought.
Can you send us a link to that? That was a really cool test. I want to be 6 now, based on what Christian said.
I know. 6-year-old, you're almost there. Yeah.
Gosh, that's just incredible. Thank you. I'm just going to add a few extra things. If we're really having a busy mind and struggling in the moment, I love all the breathing. Self-compassion is definitely one for me. Gratitude is another, because we want to access those positive neurotransmitters. Proud achievements. What are you proud of having achieved in your life? Have a look around you, family, friends, good relationships, maybe some work things in there too. So there's a number of things that we can do that just to reframe our minds, refocus our minds in a much more positive way when we're really struggling. So,
and the more you practice it,
yeah,
the more it becomes in the moment and the more it becomes of who you are.
And Amanda, before anybody is tempted to say, oh, well, you know, this gratitude journal, it's all a bit fluffy, because we used to have this thing about being in HR, it's like, oh, it's all pink
fluff. It's a bit fluffy.
It's like, absolutely, I'm the least pink fluffy person that I know. It's like, gratitude journaling is so well evidenced. They physically can monitor people releasing first dopamine when they think grateful thoughts and then serotonin when they're writing down. So it's proper hard science. And the kind of gratitude, there's a whole chapter in the book about writing things down, but also these positive thoughts, the praise that we have for ourselves. It's been proven that if you write it down, you're less likely to experience cognitive dissonance. So you're less likely to lie to yourself if you've just put yourself in a positive frame of mind by writing down things you were proud of. And I love the fact that a law professor at Yale called Dan Carhan came up with it, because it's like tick box, right? It's like, you're not going to argue with the fact that a law professor from Yale came up with that piece of research. So if anybody says pink fluff to any of those brilliant tips you've just said, it's like, it's totally hard science.
Evidence-based, scientific.
Please do them, because they actually work.
It's brilliant. And I love that you managed to get cognitive dissonance in as well, which is another one of my favourite
topics. My favourite two words now, I've rehearsed them and can say them even under pressure.
Just as I say, applied neuroscientist, there you go. Transformational neuroscientist. Living it, Dulcie.
Living the dream. So I've got a few favourite quotes then from today that I'd just like us to end on. We are what we think. I think that's really great. Where the attention goes, the energy flows. So Ian, thank you for that. Christian, thank you for the never worry alone. I'm not sure I've given any amazing quotes, but they're my three favourite quotes of today. So thank you. Does anyone else have any final thoughts for me for today?
Yeah, can I go back to the start of the book? Because actually one of my favourite quotes opens the book. I've started asking people now, if you were going to write a book, what quote would you open it with? Because we're all really into quotes. And the one that I chose wasn't from a psychologist or a neuroscientist. It came from a Harvard economist. And again, this is because sometimes I quite like talking about the pink fluff and taking it out of the equation before I start. But he said that faced with the choice between changing one's mind and proving there is no need to do so, almost everyone gets busy on the proof. And I love that quote because it helps us to understand that what very often is getting in our way as human beings of being the best version of ourselves that we can be, Christian, to go back to what you said, is the fact we get busy on the proof as to why there's no need, or why tomorrow's a better idea than today for starting that thing. And so I love the fact that that came from a Harvard economist, for the same reason that I quite like the Yale law professor one, is you can argue with it if you want, but really that's just you getting busy on the proof. Actually, go back to what he says, that changing your mind is a really hard thing to do. Growing and evolving and learning is really difficult. Embedding new habits is like really hard work. But just check in with yourself whether or not you are getting busy on the proof.
I love that. It reminds me of a quote, Dulcie. I believe it's attributed to Henry Ford. Whether you think you can or whether you think you can't, you're right. I actually think it's probably right, but you're right. And that's, I think, one of the things that we've looked at today is how could you challenge what you think you can do? And as a result, step into a space where you can start to believe. I think that visualization you're talking about again, Christian, if we can start to step into that place with the self-compassion that we are human and that we are not robots and we're not just, you know, data machines. That's the process. We can choose to be in that place. You have the choice and you can break it down. Mm-hmm. It's all very possible. I love that. Whether you think you can, you're probably right. And that lovely Galbraith quote, because that is the challenge for all of us. What do you want? Do you want to go back to the old, or do you want to try something different, a bit new? And I think that's why all of us have had that feeling of that dopamine you're talking about, Amanda. We're works in progress, as Dulcie said. We're all always to the next thing and growth. It can be quite addictive.
Thank you so very much for your contribution, you guys. We learn so much from our guests, and you two are really front and center in terms of the learning for me. So thank you very, very much.
Absolutely. Yeah. So thank you, Ian and Dulcie. It's always an open and expansive conversation. I know I always learn quite a lot, and hopefully there'll be another time that we get to have you on the podcast.
Love to.
So thanks, everybody. That now draws us to the end of this podcast. It's always enjoyable, open and expansive, and I hope you've enjoyed listening to this episode. We'd really appreciate it if you could share this with one other person who you might think might be interested in listening too. And if you've got any specific issues or topics you'd be interested in hearing more about, please use the email address. Thanks everybody for listening, and I hope you have a wonderful and successful day. Thanks, Amanda. Thanks, Dulcie, and thanks, Ian.
Thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.